Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. In this, our second episode from the GSA conference here in Denver. Today we've got a whole load of other interviews lined up for you, which will give you a flavour of the conference if you're unable to attend. And if you do actually know about the things that are going on at this conference, you can always drop me a line. I'm going to be here again tomorrow and can get interviews on specific animals or groups that you want to hear about, or with certain researchers. And some of the feedback that we actually got from the last episode that released yesterday was to do with the Mark McMenamin's research into the Mesozoic Kraken, which a lot of people felt was too controversial and that I shouldn't be given a platform to. Well, hopefully, I'd hope you'll be able to make your own minds up about the research, and I'd invite you all to leave your thoughts about it and about any of the other research that we've been talking about over this event. So there's going to be another episode released tomorrow, and I hope you're enjoying them. So I'm with Gwen Daly of the Association for Women Geosciences. Women in geosciences, is it really a male-dominated field?
I think it's become less so. I've been in this field for over 20 years, and at my first GSA meeting, there were not many women. And we've been joking about this whole meeting, how this year we no longer have our own women's bathroom to ourselves. Now, my first GSA meeting, I had my own. You'd go in, you'd have it to yourself. And really, women have become more and more visible at GSA meetings, which I think is a positive thing.
Yeah, just looking around, I'd say that it's pretty much 50-50, the proportion of women to men. As far as I can see in here, maybe it's just that there's not the women aren't going to the lectures.
In terms of the demographics, it's not nearly that close, but it's becoming better every year. It's a slow process. At the junior level, it's approaching better levels, but it is slow, and it takes generations, and we just have to be patient and understand that these things take time.
So why do you think there is a gender imbalance in geosciences?
Two generations ago, not many women went into geosciences at all. And it's only been since the 70s that significant numbers of women have started to enter the field at all. And now that they are entering in significant numbers, that's changing as people have started to really appreciate that understanding the Earth is incredibly important for understanding the future of the species. And it's become, you know, important to be able to understand how the Earth works, to be able to live on this planet sustainably. More and more types of people have become interested in geology, and that includes lots and lots of women and lots of minority groups and lots of people who, you know, weren't necessarily being, you know, interested in geology before. So instead of it being, you know, just a group of people that was one group of people that, you know, reproduced itself essentially every generation, we're starting to get more and more different types of people with different interests coming into the fields of geology, paleontology, paleoclimatology, geomorphology, all of the geosciences.
So if you're a young girl and you're perhaps thinking about a career in the geosciences, in what you could perceive to be a male-dominated field, what advice would you give that person?
My advice would be to ignore the fact that you think it's a male-dominated field and do what you want to do. You can always find excuses for not doing something you want to do. And it's getting better. And you can always find people who will discourage you. But at the same time, if you look hard enough, you can probably find people who will mentor you and encourage you, and also find resources for you to do the kind of research you wanted to do. Now, the Association for Women Geosciences were a godsend for me, for instance, when I was trying to find a job, which for most young geoscientists is the most stressful part of being a geoscientist, because the job market has been so tight. And, you know, when I would get the latest rejection letter binge coming in, they were the people who would say, look, there are more jobs. You just have to keep going. And eventually, I did find a job. But, you know, without that support, I don't know where I would be now. I'd probably be doing something else.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm in front of a poster by Selena Cole of the Ohio State University, and it's entitled A Farewell to Arms, and it's got a load of pictures of brittle stars that appear to be missing a few limbs. Could you tell me what's going on with these poor guys?
Yes, so we're doing an experiment looking at what's known as calcite aragonite seas, and oceans through the past have fluctuated in the amount of magnesium and calcium that they have. And there, it is potentially believed that when organisms are in phase, so when their skeleton is made of the same material that is precipitated during certain types of seawater being present, that they have a better chance of regenerating, better chance of growing and surviving in that water. So what we're testing is we're looking at these modern Ophiroids, which are brittle stars, and we want to test whether the regeneration rates of their arms, because they're capable of regenerating their skeletons, if that regeneration rate varies depending on the magnesium-calcium ratio of the seawater that they're in. So that's why you see all these poor brittle stars that are missing pieces of their arms. So we're hoping to potentially shed some light on how calcite aragonite seas might have influenced diversification of at least echinoderms through the past.
And do you see that they're able to produce, regenerate their arms quicker in certain water chemistries?
Well, at this point, we're still in the middle of the experiment. We have discovered that they have a much harder time in the very low magnesium to calcium ratio seawater. And so it's been suggested that during these periods of calcite seas, they would have regenerated slowly. So that is one hypothesis. But at this point, we really don't have enough data to be able to see whether or not those regeneration rates vary.
So that means you're going to be cutting some more arms off.
Yes.
Poor guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm now with Anne-Marie Jones of Kent State University, Ohio, and she's got a poster on the intersex specimens of fossil crabs. Could you tell us about these, please?
So this is really interesting because out of 2,500 specimens, I found 8 that show both male and female morphology. Pretty much like the sternum or the ventral side of the organism has... the male morphology is a really thin, skinny pleon or tail. Females have really wide pleons. And then they have little tiny holes on their legs. Females have them on their third leg. Males have them on their fifth. And I found a whole bunch of specimens that have, like, say, male pleons but female placement gonopores. And then I also found some that have gonopores on the fourth leg, which makes no sense whatsoever. I can't find anything analogous, modern or other fossil crabs, nothing that has a gonopore on the fourth.
Okay, so are these characters that you're talking about to do with the genitalia at all?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay, because sometimes you can get sexual dimorphism, like difference between the sexes, that is just structural.
Yes.
So, but this is genitalia related.
Yeah, so the female gonopores, those release eggs. And the male gonopores release sperm, and males will insert the sperm into a spermatheca, which is another little hole on the sternum that you can't see very often. And then females release their gonopore or their eggs through their gonopores, and once they're fertilized, they keep them between the pleon and the sternum. That is why the pleon is so wide for females.
Okay, so are these ones that display both sexual characteristics, are they hermaphroditic?
I don't consider these hermaphroditic because it is not, intersex is not part of the their life history. So it's, I guess you could say it's some kind of mutant. It's not ontogenetic.
But can you get hermaphrodites in other kind of decapod, crab, lobster kind of animals?
Yes, you can, especially shrimp. But I can't compare those to crabs. They're very different life histories. But they, you do. You can find hermaphrodites in other crustaceans. You can find a lot of abnormal intersex in modern crabs. A lot of it has to do with pollutants. Or there's a lot of evidence of barnacles. And you'll get like a parasitic barnacle that'll turn one half of the crab into male morphology and the other half is female morphology. So you get this like weird looking pleon, like one side really wide, the other's skinny. So it's very interesting. But I couldn't pin down a reason why we see these because I don't have internal anatomy since they're fossils.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So a poster I've just come across is an attempt to quantify patterns of fractured skeletons that have been trampled upon. So could you tell us who you are and what you're looking at?
I'm Sophie Kolonkowski. I'm from the State University of New York at Oneonta. And I was looking at fracture patterns due to trampling on small to medium vertebrates. So in my research, we used a fish, a mouse, and a mink for each experiment. And we also did fresh bones and weathered bones. The weathered bones were bones that we put in an oven for 3 hours at 70 degrees C. And we went through, I actually had to skin and eviscerate all of these in order to put them, dry them out and put them in a dermestid beetle tank for them to eat the flesh off of them. Pretty grueling. but that was to sort of get rid of any, or rather prevent any unnecessary alterations to the bones like you would have if you boiled them or you know, cut the meat off or whatever with a knife. And then I went through. I took every bone from all of the skeletons and I performed control experiments. And I dropped a mass on each bone and recorded the number of fragments, the fracture types, and for both the fresh and weathered, and the acting mass. And we sort of plotted that up to see if there were any differences initially between the fragments, the acting masses, if there were any differences between small and larger bones and everything, and the same with the fracture types. And then we went on to do the actual trampling experiment, and we had 6 people trample the skeletons on sand and mud. They were trampled a total of 18 times, and we actually came up with significantly less broken bones for the trampling experiment. I mean, the weathered mink on sand only had 2 broken bones in the entire skeleton after we trampled on it. So it was really interesting. We found that some of the bones do behave differently than others. Columnar and irregular behave very differently than equine or platy, and that sand and mud bones broken on each of those behave differently from each other, and it was really neat.
So how does this relate to the what we see in the fossil record? What questions are you trying to answer?
So we're looking at sort of, can we look at these different fractures in a bone assemblage in the fossil record and then come in and say, oh, something at maybe this weight trampled this, or, you know, this type of fracture means that this type of animal could have trampled here, or, you know, et cetera. Just sort of piecing back together the puzzle of how that was done. And that could give us some interesting insights to paleoecology as well.
So most of the time, fossils are flattened anyway. So are you able to tell the difference between a skeleton that's been compressed in the normal rock forming process to something that's been trampled on?
That might be a whole nother experiment. I guess you could... I hesitate to say this, but I suppose you could probably use the fracture types as sort of like an indicator. Although, under any mass, a bone is going to break into a certain fracture type. But, yeah, I mean, looking at it, we did see that just humans trampling on these bones, we barely had any broken bones. So if you have a very large number of broken bones, it might just be that a large mass crushed these bones, or that a very large animal trampled it, like an elephant or something. Or a mammoth.
And so you're using bones that don't have any flesh on them. Is there any intention of trampling on animals with flesh on them?
I will probably not do that project, but I think it would be an interesting thing to look at. I think that there would definitely be differences in the way that it fractures, just because it sort of has that extra cushion around it. I think there would definitely be some differences, and especially the substrates and everything too.
And then, this might not go in, but is there anything in the fossil record, any direct evidence of trampling, like a fossil trackway with a little squished animal?
You know, I didn't look into specifically that. There are, I imagine, bone assemblages with, because there are many, many projects on trampling out there. I imagine there's probably bone assemblages with tracks maybe away from it, maybe not necessarily recorded on top of the bones, but leading away from them or something of that sort.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks.
So I'm here with Neil Mondal, who's from the University of South Florida, and he's got a poster about boring gastropods.
Yep.
Now, they're not that boring, are they?
So I should not call it boring. I will call it drilling, because the mechanism is drilling bivalve cells. So it's kind of drilling mechanism by using their mechanical tooth. So that's why I will call it drilling bivalve.
Okay, so what did these gastropods drill into?
These gastropods are carnivorous gastropods, so they need food, and their preferable food is mostly bivalves, but they also drill gastropods, other gastropods, brachiopods, and all other prey. So, but the thing is, they mostly concentrate on bivalves, so bivalve cells, irrespective of their ecological character. That means that bivalves may be infaunal, living well within the sediment. They may be epifaunal, just like oysters, living outside the sediments. Or maybe they are semi-infaunal, like some percentage of their body within the sediment and some percentage outside the sediment. So they kill that guy in order to extract soft part out of them. So that's the thing.
And so your study was looking at if the gastropods had any preference as to which of the bivalves they preyed on, whether they were in the sediment or on top of the sediment.
Right.
So what was the result of that?
Yeah, the result is, so we actually plotted all these drilled bivalves throughout our time interval, and it appears that most of the drilled bivalves were represented by infaunal forms. That means infaunal bivalves were mostly drilled throughout the time interval, starting from Triassic to Paleogene time. So it appears that if a bivalve is living outside sediment-water interface, that on the sediment, they will be drilled more frequently. That's a straightforward interpretation.
So they preferred the ones that were inside the sediment?
Basically, yep. So basically infaunal, yep. So if you were living within the sediment, they will be attacked more frequently. So that's a straightforward interpretation, but that can be interpreted in other way. Like, if they're attacking more and more infaunal prey, it may be interpreted by prey preference. That means they were preferring more infaunal prey. Another interpretation may be because infaunal prey are more abundant and more available in our ecosystem, modern and fossil ecosystem. So if they are more available, they will have more encounter with that movable drilling gastropods. So if they have more encounter, they will be more frequently attacked, and that's why probably we are having more and more drilled infernal bivalves in our record. So my interpretation will be, because that kind of preference toward infernal life form is simply due to the fact that infernal bivalves are more frequently present in our ecosystem, so which is very common all over the geological time period.
So the only reason that there were more infernal bivalves being drilled was that there were more infernal bivalves present. So it's not a preference.
Yeah, it's
they're
not
just
a preference.
Drilling into whatever they can find.
Yeah, right. That's the case, because if you are living in a normal ecological condition where stress is there and you have other predators, like these guys, these gastropods are attacked by crabs and other gastropods. So you are well within a dangerous zone. So your goal should be to target which is very available in the ecosystem. Just try them which are very abundant. Don't look for uncommon guys, look for the most common guys. So that's why probably infernal bivalves were more abundant, more common, and that's why they have been drilled more frequently.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
So I had ice cream. It made me feel so much better. But yeah.
So this is your first talk?
Yes, this is my first conference.
Okay.
And there's no one else from my department here.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been pretty exciting.
Well, that's your introduction.
That's
so,
great.
For everyone else who can't see a badge, this is Ali Baumgartner, who gave a talk today. What was it on?
It was on the paleoclimate of Neogene Eastern North America and three mid-Atlantic sites. Would you like me to be more specific?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay, so it was two sites in Maryland, the Bryn Mawr and the Brandywine, and one in New Jersey, the Legler Lignite. They're both, three of them are about middle Miocene to late Miocene in age. So lots of dead plants.
And so what were you able to work out about the paleoclimate?
Well, we don't know much about the paleoclimate of eastern North America in the Neogene. There aren't that many exposures. But those three sites were fairly close together in time and space. So we were able to basically confirm what we expected. There was a decrease in temperature from the beginning of the Cenozoic into the Pleistocene. The older sites were warmer and wetter than today, whereas the younger sites were more similar than what you would see today, which was really exciting because that's what we expected.
And so what did you actually look at? You say you were looking at plants.
Yes.
What about them?
I was looking at the fossil plants from the site. There are some pollen, some leaves, and I was using the climatic requirements of the nearest living relatives to figure out what the temperature was like. There's seven climate parameters, some precipitation, some temperature, and you find where everything overlaps, and that's what your range is. I was using genera, so that's kind of a problem because, like, all oaks have a very large climatic range. But it was really cool. It's funny, I tell people I do paleoclimate, they're like, you deal with dead plants. That's not exciting. But it really actually is, because, you know, you can look at the climate of these places and see how drastically different it was. Like, New Jersey used to have tree ferns. And just kind of, it's so surprising to think about that. But, yeah, by looking at the fossil taxa and then looking at the modern requirements, you can get an idea of what the temperature and what the precipitation was like.
Thanks, Ali.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for day two. Tonight I'm going to be appearing on the Paleo After Dark podcast, so if you're subscribed to that, look out for this episode coming soon. I think they're releasing it at the end of this little conference season, so it should be worth listening to, although I'm not sure that I'll be able to keep up with the academic level of some of the other guys on that podcast. So thanks for listening, and please leave any thoughts that you have in the comments, and I'll see you all tomorrow.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.